Right. Today is a complicated day because it's of course Yom HaZikaron, and we're leading into Yom HaAtzmaut. We don't have a shir tomorrow, so I found myself torn in terms of how to handle it. You go one to the other. So the question is right. And right now, actually, we're getting much closer in Israel. And every year, actually, around this time on my social media feed, I always see, you know, in a few hours from now, you know, we're observing Yom HaZikaron, and you start to see the singing and dancing in the streets in Israel, and it's so striking, but that's actually part of the juxtaposition. It's also part of the reminder of what it means to still be in exile, not there, where it's being fully appreciated and really commemorate and celebrate in that way. On Yom HaZikaron, I cannot but remember some of the connections that I have. So this past year, I think on Yom Kippur, I told the story about the time I was supposed to be in the yeshiva in Otniel, which is south of Hebron, when there was a terror attack there. It's a story that I've told before. But there's also the story I still remember of when I was a Shana Bet student in Israel, of a young man by the name of Yoni Jesner. Yoni Jesner was a Shana Aleph student at the time. He was from Glasgow, and he was very active in Bnei Akiva, and he was not a chayal or anything like that. He was simply a tragically a victim of terror 2 days before Sukkot. He was killed in a bus bombing in Tel Aviv, visiting family. I think I may have mentioned this in context of organ donation, because that was the story, that's the context. But I think of it not in context of medical ethics side, but in context of those that I had a connection with who have given up so much. And of course, there are so many, and there's so many stories. But I think that to take the opportunity to think not just globally about the sacrifices that have been made, but if there are any personal connections that we have, and to learn about individual stories, whether it's a personal connection or whatever it might be, I think is, we were just talking about earlier in context of the Shoah, that sometimes learning about one story is really a much more compelling way to begin to appreciate, and then you magnify that one story, and I think that there's truth to that here as well. So for me, many of these incidents, and there are many others, are certainly on my mind, and yet at the same time, we got Yom HaAtzmaut and the 70th anniversary of that. So I was a little bit torn in terms of what I wanted to do, and I just felt, and I feel emotional about it, and I think that there's a certain profundity to the fact that we're here, and it's almost normalized, and it's almost at this point taken for granted, and yet we can't take it for granted. So I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with it, and since I was feeling that sense of emotional connection, I wanted to come back to something I've done variations of this in past years. I wanted to come back to two of my great Zionist heroes for me personally, and to show a little bit of the literary or even poetic connection between them. And that is, on the one hand, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, a sweet singer of Israel who lived in the Middle Ages, from roughly 1075 to 1140, 1141 on the one hand, and something of a relatively more modern day hero, more recent hero, which is Rav Kook. For me personally, and when I think about Zionism, these have been incredibly nourishing and inspiring personalities. And what I wanted to do is to spend just a few minutes, we'll do a little bit of history and a little bit of poetry today. It's a little bit of a change. The good news is I have Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in both Hebrew and English. Rav Kook, I don't have a full translation into the English, but we're going to do it together. And what I want to suggest is that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has had such a profound impact that not only do we find him and his words resonating in modern-day Israel, for example, many of the lyrics of Yushalayim Shel Zahav are borrowed directly from his very, very famous song and poem, Tzion Halotei Shali, which we're going to read today. But also, I want to suggest that on a certain level, some of the poems of Rav Kook, which I discovered just 3 or 4 days ago, actually, I want to suggest have hints, resonances of some of the poetry that goes all the way back. Actually, I just want to show you where this was, where I found this. I have the sefer over here. I have a white book over here. This is Rav Kook's. There's something called the Shas Halavan in Israel, religious Zionist circles. No, Shas stands for Shisha Sidre Mishnah, which means basically is a reference to the Talmud. Right? So typically, traditionally, Shas means the Gemara. Right? So if you turn around, you have all of your Megamara on the second to bottom shelf over there. That's Shas. Well, Rav Kook had such a profound impact in religious Zionist circles that they almost, some would say heretically, others would say proudly, call it the Shas HaLavan, which is that there's an entire white set of Rav Kook's writings. Rav Kook, of course, will come to as highly controversial during his lifetime, but certainly for the religious Zionist community in Israel today remains probably the foremost influence. And so I'm actually taking a course, and we were studying his work on repentance, Orot HaTeshuvah. And I'll share a little bit about this. Orot HaTeshuvah, actually, Rav Kook sees repentance very, very broadly, and he sees it as almost a cosmic process of return to the spiritual roots of the universe. Rav Kook, there's an element of divinity in everything, and therefore repentance is really about the entirety of the universe, individuals, nations, including the Jewish people, and really all of existence returning to its divine roots, as it were. And so Rav Kook, part of that return is he sees the Zionist movement as actually a massive event of teshuvah, of return of the Jewish people to our historical roots, which is a radical, you know, paradigm shift in terms of what teshuvah represents. So one of the courses that I'm taking online in my graduate program, we were assigned, the instructor says, oh, it's no big deal, just read all of the Orot HaTeshuvah for the next class. Orat Shuvah is 50 pages in difficult Hebrew. Sure, no problem, professor. I got it. Not a problem. It's like one of our AP classes, you know, where the teacher just gets up and says, you know, oh, just read, you know, the next three chapters for tomorrow's class, right? No big deal. I'm sure we've done it in Tikvah before. I'll confess. I've done it to my students 2 days. Anyhow, so I'm reading through Orat Shuvah. I'm preparing. I originally thought I wasn't even going to be able to be present at the class. I told the press I'm not sure I'll be able to be there. Of course, the way it worked out, I was able to attend the class. I do it remotely, so I do it. That means I was able to attend my class from my computer. And of course, there are a number of student presentations. In my luck, the professor says, oh, you're here. It's your turn to present. He insists that it was random. It was by lottery. I'm like, oh, man, I wasn't even supposed to be here. All right, so I'll give it a whirl. So I went and I winged it, and I think it went okay. So I think I've had practice here. I think I've done Rav Kook here. In past years, at some point, some of you might have had learned Rav Kook with me, so it wasn't so big a deal. But one of the great joys was that I was actually looking through Orot HaTeshuvah, and I noticed that afterward, Rav Kook has a number of poems. Some of the poems, and we'll go through his biography a little bit briefly later, are his poems prior to when he made Aliyah, and some of them are post-Aliyah. And Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaSmana coming up this week, I've got to read this. This is perfect, the post-Aliyah poetry. And he starts talking about the transition from exile to redemption. And then I start to see some of the phraseology that comes from one of my favorite poems in the entire world, Sion Halo Tishali, which ironically is recited, by the way, on Tish Abav, even though it's one of the keynotes, which is completely ironic because it's one of the most optimistic and beautiful and inspirational and aspirational poems that I've ever read in my entire life. And of course, that's why Sion Halo Tishali on Tish Abav is read later in the day, because you're turning a little bit more toward the consolation of Tish Abav. But it's all there, so it's really a beautiful thing. These I have not yet given out, but you're more than welcome to take. They're not a secret, I promise, but this is what everyone has so far. So therefore, what I wanted to do is as follows. A couple of words about Rabbi Huda Halevi, to read through Sion Halo Tishali, and then to take a look at three very small poems from Rav Kook, which I think draw on a little bit, at least, on Rav Kook, and rather Rabbi Huda Halevi, and I think bridge sort of the Zionist vision. We're bridging now 70 years since establishing the State of Israel, and this really bridges some 800 or so years, really, across history, from the passing of Rabbi Huda Halevi in roughly 1140 to the passing of Rav Kook in roughly 1935, and I think it just brings together that sense that this is really an overarching vision of ours for hundreds and indeed thousands of years. So that's what I want to do a little bit of. So first a word on Rabbi Huda Halevi and his own life story. I'm not going to go through the entirety of it, obviously, but just half a word to contextualize. Rabbi Huda Halevi, we give the years. He's living in Spain. And he actually is part of a group of what's called, that's living in Andalusian Spain, known as the period of the Golden Age of Spain. And this is a time when the relationship between the Jews and the Arab Muslims at that time was relatively positive, certainly not perfect, and there were pogroms here and there, but on the whole, it was actually a very positive era, and there were many opportunities for Jews to interact with their Arabic neighbors, and there was a lot of poetry that was written in relation to one another, and there's a beautiful sort of symmetry almost, in reciprocity. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi actually traveled, he lived in Granada for much of his life, and he actually would go into, you know, what in England today might be called a pub. That's what they had, except they were sort of high-level pubs, basically, where the greatest poets of the day would be spending time. You imagine something in Berlin or something in Paris or something like this. You know, a salon might be more right. Yeah, might be right. Might be right. Okay, might be more appropriate analogy.
Sorry.
Okay, so the Arabic salons and what you had. And this might seem quite distant for us, but you actually had some of the greatest Jewish thinkers, poets, and minds of the day who were collaborating with their Arabic friends, quite literally their Muslim friends, and they were writing and borrowing, and there was a lot of this cultural exchange that was taking place during these years. A very beautiful and in many ways an uplifting time. And it was a time that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is toward the very end of that period. The rise of Jewish history classes in past years, the rise of the Almohad, a radical Islamic sect in 1147 puts an end to this, and that's why the Rambam is born shortly after this, has a much more difficult life. But Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, relatively speaking, with some exception, basically lives a relatively peaceful and positive life. Of course, we know that his great philosophical contribution is the Kuzari, which is that despite the fact that he personally had very positive relationships with the Muslims of his time, in general, the Jews were scattered in exile and felt very much like second-class citizens. And the Christian theology at that time was very much that, yes, there's a reason for that, which is supersessionism, that you've been replaced by God, there's a new chosen people. And so he writes this book, this imagined conversation between the Khazar king and the Chacham, essentially, and this Jewish scholar, this rabbi, which is based on what we now know is in fact a historical story, which is that the Khazar king in the Far East, the Caspian Sea, actually did convert his entire nation to Judaism. He certainly converted, and we're quite confident, we're almost 100% certain, that he converted his entire kingdom and that he corresponded with an earlier Jewish scholar a few hundred years prior. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi imagines this conversation as to how the Khazar king came to convert. And through this conversation, the Khazar king is imagined to come to Judaism. And we know that toward the very end of the story, echoing his own life story, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi imagines that the Chacham, having explained that Jerusalem and that the land of Israel is the pulsating heart of the Jewish people, ultimately the king calls on his hypocrisy and says, "No, right? If this is where the Jews are meant to be, so what are you doing here? Right? You should be consistent." And the scholar says, "You know what? You're right. My actions need to follow my principles." In fact, in the fictional retelling, the Chacham, and then this is the end of this is right. If you're writing a plot, if you're a scriptwriter, you have to have some way to complete your plot, right? So there's got to be something to bring to a close. This is how that conversation ends. So I gave that to you on the conclusion of the book. And I'm sorry that the English is a little bit archaic. It's a little bit Shakespearean, as you'll see. But the rabbi was then concerned to leave the land of the Khazar, Khazarian, to betake himself to Jerusalem. The king was, that should be, I think, loath to let him go, and spoke to him in this sense as follows: "What can be sown in Palestine nowadays, since the divine reflex is absent from it?" And there's nothing there. It's a bunch of crusaders. "Whilst with a pure mind and desire one can approach God in any place, why will thou run to danger on land and water among various peoples?" The rabbi answered, "The visible Shekhinah is indeed disappears because it does not reveal itself except to a prophet or a favored community in a distinguished place. This is what we look for in the passage. Let our eyes behold when thou returnest to Zion as regards the invisible and spiritual Shekhinah, divine presence. It is with every born Israelite a virtuous life, pure heart and upright mind," and so on and so forth. And he says essentially that he's willing to incur the danger, five lines six lines from the bottom of that paragraph, he braves danger, and if he escapes, he praises God gratefully. But should he perish through his sins, he has obtained the divine favor, may be confident, is atoned for the most of his sins by death. In my opinion, this is better than to seek the dangers of war in order to gain fame and spoil by courage and bravery. This kind of danger is even inferior to those who march into war for hire. In other words, he's willing to put his life on the line, quite literally, in order to make Aliyah. And that ultimately is exactly what he does. That ends up, that's the end of the story. If you go to the next side, it says toward the end of the line, about 7-8 lines down, it is, however, rather useful to show the good intention. The deed is impossible. As we express this in our prayer, on account of our sins have we been driven out of our land. This sacred place serves to remind men and to stimulate them to love God, being a reward and promise, as it is written, "Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion." For the time to favor her, yeah, the set time has come, right? For the servants take pleasure in her stones and embrace the dust thereof. This means that Jerusalem can only be rebuilt when Israel yearns for it to such an extent that they embrace her stones and dust. And the king says, if that's the case, then it's a sin to hold you back. Good, right? Best of luck on your journey. And so the imagined journey, of course, we know that this anticipates the actual journey of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. We know that there's a famous legend that he attempted Aliyah toward the very end of his life, arrived at the gates of Jerusalem, was trampled by the Arab horsemen as he fulfilled his final request. That's the legend. We actually now have new historical evidence that is actually based on the Cairo Geniza. And we actually now are quite confident, we're almost certain that he made it. And that he spent the last months, at least, of his life in the land of Israel, living out the dream. This was an incredibly difficult journey. He did so for purely religious and spiritual reasons. And one of the most inspiring Zionist stories that we have ever heard. And indeed, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's poetry speaks volumes, very famously, about his great love for the love of Israel. Right, he's in the West. Right, his heart, of course, is in the East, and we have all this very beautiful poetry.
So, how old was he
when he? So he was. It was within the last couple months of his life. So, if you do the math, he was approximately 65 years old. It was literally the last years of his life. At that time, that was incredibly old. It was an incredibly arduous journey for him.
That's awesome that he did.
He got trapped in Egypt for some time. The community in Alexandria embraced him with open arms. So there are reports that we actually have letters. I think he went with his son. We now have letters from the Geniza that document how the community received him with celebration and actually encouraged him not to go. And he initially wanted to go at one point, and then the weather turned and he wasn't able to make the journey initially, and he had all sorts of holdups, and ultimately he went, we think, by sea from, actually, ultimately, up to Yafo, I want to say.
So what I had read was actually that he didn't make it, that his ship was shipwrecked.
So there, that was the initial thought, but we actually believe that he did. Sometimes the inspiring stories actually turn out to be true.
Because I was like heartbroken.
My historical research is based on Hillel Halkin's book. Hillel Halkin wrote a recent biography.
Yeah.
And what he did is he actually weaves together the history, the poetry, and the new documents. He actually translated Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's poetry prior to this, and then he takes his translations, he weaves it into a gorgeous, stunning biography, published it about 2 years ago with Shocking Books, so you have that. That's the best of my understanding. That's my understanding. And so he writes this very famous kina, but it's so uplifting, and I wanted to go through it. You could stop on every word. You could analyze its antecedents in Tanakh. You could do this in great depth. That's not what I'm going to do. But I really want to do this. I want to read it, understand it, and just also get a sense for the, more than anything else, for just the soul, for the spirit of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi that comes through. And that resonates with me so deeply at times like today. So he writes, Tzion halo tishali lishlom asirayach. Zion. Right, so in other words, he directly addresses Tzion. This is almost an imagined conversation, just like the king imagined conversation between the Chacham and the Kuzari king. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi imagined a conversation between him and the city of Jerusalem, because of course at this time he did not yet have access. He's off in Spain. Tzion halo tishali lishlom asirayach, Zion, will you not ask about the welfare of your imprisoned ones? right? In other words, the Jews who are imprisoned in exile throughout the world, won't you at least ask about how they're doing? Dorshei Shalomeich, those who seek out your peace, in other words, we pray constantly for the peace of Jerusalem, Behem Yeter Azarayich, and they're the remnants of your flock. Okay, I'm not going to, you can follow in the English, I'll just do my own translation, we have there as well. Miyam, Umizrach, Umitzafon, Vitiman, from west and east, from north and from south, Shalom, Rachok, Vikarov, right? The peace from those who are distant and those who are close, Si'i, you should lift up, Mikol Avarayach, from every single direction. Ushlom, Asir, they say Ta'ava here, but we have generally Asir Tikva. Right? It's generally how it's I don't know if there are different texts or what the story is, but usually it's Asir Tikva. And the welfare, this is such a beautiful phrase that he invented essentially, Asir Tikva, let's say. Asir, as he says, Asirayach, is from Beta Asurim, which means someone who is imprisoned. The one is who, right? Imprisoned of hope. Right? In other words, Asir Tikva, the one who's bound up in hope, which I think is a double meaning, that the hope binds us, the hope almost is enwrapping us, encircles us, but at the same time we are imprisoned because we are off in exile, and so there's this personification, gorgeous personification. We'll see there's a ton of personification, imagination, and as we'll see, alliteration that run throughout this beautiful, beautiful song. So Ushlom Asir Tikva, the peace of the one who is bound with hope, and of course HaTikva. It's not a coincidence. Hatikva, notin dema'av kital Hermon, who gives its tears like the dew of the Hermon mountain, off in the north of Israel, the Nechsaf, and of course now you can go. It's so beautiful for him. These are just imagined biblical places. Now you can go, right? Now you can go skiing on the Hermon. I mean, it's unbelievable. The Nechsaf. Nechsaf is a beautiful and a very deep word for passion, or as a craving. A very deep desire, liritama hararayach. In other words, the only desire, the great desire of the Jewish people is to shed the tears such that they fall, liritam, from yarad, to go down, hararayach. All our desire is merely all we want is to cry now on the Hermon. So again, the admixture of exile and inspiration that you have here. Livkot enuteich anitanim, and this is also another a self personification, as it were, to cry over your suffering. Anitanim, I am a jackal. Right, and that goes back to the biblical image from Echa, where you have jackals who cry at the Temple Mount. There's also a beautiful story in the Gemara at the end of Masachet Makot, where Rabbi Akiva sees jackals. They say foxes, but really it's jackals, probably, emerging from what used to be the place of the Holy of Holies, and instead of crying, he actually laughs. And the rabbis ask, why are you laughing? How can you see the place of the Temple Mount in desolation? You're laughing. And he says, well, just as the prophecy, the negative prophecy occurred, so too, that is a guarantee that the positive prophecy of Uriah will take place, will unfold as well. And the rabbis famously say, Akiva nichantano, Akiva nichantano, Akiva, you have comforted us, Akiva, you have comforted us. So even that again, he's playing on all these themes. You have the verse in Echa, but also you have the Talmudic passage, the admixture of the crying and the aspiration and the hope. So livkot enuteich anitanim. He says, I'm not just like a jackal, he says, I am a jackal. As you see that he's a professional poet. He was a professional poet, indeed, among other things. Ve'etech alom shivat shivutech, and you start to see a lot of the alliteration here, right? Livkot anutech anitanim, right? You can see the nuns and the tafs, right? Ve'et and taf again. Echalom shivat shivutech, when I imagine the return of your captivity, shivat shivutech. Right? So those are, again, you've seen it's the play of words that are so similar. The return of your captive, right, is almost as if to suggest that one is bound up with the other. Again, crying and laughing are bound up with one another. Return of a captive. It's not unintentional that in Hebrew those share very similar roots. He says, Ani chinor l'shirayach. Ani chinor l'shirayach. I'm not like a harp. I am a chinor l'shirayach. And of course, this is the source for.
This is
Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Right, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Naomi Shemer, right, new Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, and right, new Sion Halutz Yishali, and took her chorus directly from this very beautiful and timeless poem. And then he says, all I desire is to see these holy places. My heart for Beit El and Pniel, these biblical references. And again, each one has deep resonances. He's not just choosing them out of a hat. We can analyze each one. Me'od Yehemeh, desperately craves for. Ulemachanayim, right? These are places, Yaakov Avinu and the Avot. These are the patriarchs specifically. V'chol pig'ei tahorayach, in all the places where your holy, where your pure ones encountered, right? In other words, he's referencing the Avot. And Imahot. Sham hashchina shchunalach. This is where you just can't get it in the English, right? You see the alliteration, just that's where Sham hashchina shchunalach. Right, I mean, you see his mastery over the Hebrew language. It's gorgeous. That's where the, right, or they say Shechina in this one, usually Shechuna. This is where the Divine Presence is living for you. In other words, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, we may be no longer living there, but the Shechina is everlasting. Right? In other words, this is a he's a romantic. Right? This, in essence, he's a poet, but he's also a romantic, and he's able, and he's a mystic. He's able to see the Divine Presence even where physically it's no longer represented. And that's exactly, of course, what he said in the Kuzari. That's what the Chacham says, who's the mouthpiece of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. He said, well, maybe there are no physical people living there. The king says, well, what do you mean? It's there's nothing there. It's desolate. Right? And he says, it might be physically desolate, spiritually. It is alive with the sound of music, you'll forgive me, right? That's exactly, I don't know if that's necessarily the source, but it works out nicely too. Now, he continues, which basically, again, you see the alliteration, but basically it means that your creator basically made that the pathway, the meeting place between heaven and earth. At the place of Yerushalayim in particular, the Beit HaMikdash even more specifically, Eretz Yisrael in general, that's the place where the meeting place between heaven and earth, that's he referred before to Machanayim intentionally, right? That's where Yaakov Avinu saw the angels ascending and descending on the ladder, because of course, that's exactly what it was according to the Midrashic tradition that took place in Har HaMoriah. Yaakov Avinu says, right, he had no idea, Zer Shar HaShemayim, this is the gateway to heaven. So Rida Levi is picking up on that entire Midrashic tradition. The honor of God was your source of light. We didn't need a sun, a moon, and stars. We had the Shechina. That was the source of enlightenment. We never even needed those to enlighten this space. If char l'nafshi, I would choose for myself l'hishtapich, to be poured out b'mkom asheruach l'okim shfuchal b'chirayich, in the place where the Spirit of God was poured out on your chosen ones. In other words, the patriarchs and all those who walked the land of Israel, they were walking through the Divine Presence. He says, if only I could. He's imagining himself. Imagine if I could actually walk through these spaces now myself. I'm trapped here in Spain. But that's the unbelievable thing, because later on he does exactly this, right? I would argue, right? So we now know. And that was certainly his plan. That's what he desired. That was his great... This is someone who lived his principles, right? At Beit Milucha, V'at Kisei Ad Hashem. You are the house of kingship. You are the seat of the Lord. And we're going to see some of this coming back. How can it be that servants now sit upon the seats of your great princes? And now he says something that's both gorgeous and we'll see echoed in Rav Kook. He says, who would give me if only I could float? Right? There were no airplanes yet. You couldn't say halal. So instead, what he wants to do is he imagines himself floating above the land. This is someone who never saw Israel, ever.
Sounds like a Chagall painting.
Right? I mean, oh, interesting. In the place where God reveals himself to your seers, to your prophets, who will create wings for me, and I'll go distantly. And again, the alliteration, which is just unbelievably brilliant, which means that he's going to move among, right, which is a play on word, among the shattered parts of my heart, right? So that means the different parts of my heart, being the tarayach, between your pieces, which is a reference to the covenant of the pieces, the Brit Bin Abtarim. So he has a broken heart. He wants to now take his broken heart and to be healed by going to the same place where God made the covenant to give Abraham the land of Israel with the covenant of the pieces. Ingenious And he does it with, right, it's this shattered heart. You've got that imagery. And he wants to actually go and to live this out. And now you see the Kuzari, and you see where the legend comes from also. Epola apai, I only desire to fall on my face. So every time you see someone falling on their face, they're reliving, right, kissing, like coming off the plane and kissing, kissing the ground. I don't know if anyone has actually seen this, but I've actually,
seen
you, what? Right, we've certainly seen it, right? They're reliving, this was the dream, they're reliving the dream of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, Apola, Pia, Ale, Artzeich, right? If only I could, this is all he wanted in his life. I could fall on my face, pan your land, Vartzav, Anayich, and crave your stones, Bachonin and Afarayich, when people bring back Jerusalem stone, when they bring back a little bit of the dirt of Israel, right? One of my students just I asked him. He came back from Israel. So those who know the Chasky family, God, there is in Israel. So Gabriel's one of my students. I said to Gabriel, I said, "New, like, do you have some stone or some dirt for me?" He said, "I think in my shoe, I still have a little bit left over." I said, "I need
mine
some."
Mine was confiscated.
I said, "I need some of that pixie dust. I wish you brought me more." So, and then he continues. He goes on, and I'm not going to read every single part just because I want to give time for the Rav Kook. He says, imagines himself standing at the graves. We're going to see this coming up in Rav Kook as well. That's going to be important. He sees Har Ha'avarim V'Hor Ha'har, about 10 lines down, which is where Moshe and Aaron are buried, right? Or Aaron and Moshe. Moshe and Aaron, respectively. Asher Sham Shnei Orim Gedolim Mi'irayach Umorayach. That's where our great, again, going back to the light motif, that's where Moshe and Aaron are buried. He says he wants to walk. He says the source of life, of all life for the entire universe. Right? For him, it's sort of the life force. This, by the way, had halachic ramifications as well for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. I know there is a major controversy about, according to halacha, where do we draw the international dateline? Right, because we know that there needs to be an international dateline, and a number of hundreds of years ago, there's a halachic literature that developed trying to figure out, well, do we follow the international dateline, the convention? Do we have our own way of determining that? What day is it in Japan right now? These are really major issues. When the Mir Yeshiva was exiled to Japan, they had to figure out, depending on the different views about, in terms of in Shanghai, what halachic day was it? There's a lot of literature about this. The earliest known halachic source about this is actually in the Kuzari itself. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, and in his opinion, the Midrash says, and the rabbis teach us, that Yushalayim was the source of the creation of the universe. So therefore, he thinks that is sort of the epicenter, and he therefore argues that the international dateline is 180 degrees from, it's the opposite end of the earth, from Yushalayim, because that's sort of the beginning point, so then the midpoint, as it were, would be 180 degrees, and it was halfway around the globe from there, which is very, very interesting, which is not clear that we follow that halacha, but in other words, this is something that he wrote about, this is something that he lived out, and it even informed his psak halacha. All of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was wrapped up in this love of Zion. It's unbelievable. He goes on, there's more, there's much more. Let me just point out one or two points that'll be relevant, and then we'll come to Rav Kook. If you go down to where it says, Ich Ye'erav Li, about 14 lines down in the Hebrew, he says, how can it be, Ich Ye'erav Li, how can it be joyous for me? Like, Arev is sweet. How can it be sweet for me? Achol Ishto Be'ire Chazet, to eat and drink at a time when I see, Ki Yischavu Aklavim Etz Kif Yirayach, that dogs are essentially eating your young lions. Who are the young lions? The dogs eating young lions? This is a more horrific image. The young lions are a metaphor for the Jewish people in Tanakh. And we're going to see that coming back. A kfir is a young lion, by the way, in Benching. Right? Kfirim rashu v'ra'evu. Ever stop and wonder? Kfirim rashu v'ra'evu. V'darshi Hashem l'yachzeru chotov. What in the world does that mean? Right? So our kids learn the song, but we never actually stop and think about things. So it actually means Kfirim Rashu V'ra'evu, means young lions. It's a statement about God's kindness, actually, in Benjamin. It's Vatzim Tilim, really. But Kfirim Rashu V'ra'evu, young lions arashu v'ra'ivu, were impoverished and hungry. In other words, those who you would have thought would be able to get food are not able to get food. V'dorshei Hashem, but those who seek out God, lo yachzeru chol tov, will not lack any good. That's sort of a statement, you know. There are questions that are raised about that. Well, what about, you know, is that really true? And there are a lot of questions that come up, but that's what the word actually means. It means a young lion. That's how, and it's used a metaphor for the Jewish people. And then it becomes sadder, and he talks about the losses and so on and so forth. And then he ends up with a more positive plea for the future. Okay. So this is one of the most influential, inspiring, alliterative, beautiful poems that was ever written about love for Israel, and love for Tzion in particular. And of course, the latter-day lover, great lover of Zion, was of course, among others, Rav Kook. And so I bumped into these poems, as I mentioned earlier, and I wanted to share at least a couple of them with you. And I apologize, I do not have the English translation for these, but we will go through it together. Just a word about Rav Kook and his love of Zion. Rav Kook was born, as you said, I said he died in 1935, he was born in 1865. So he lives roughly 70 years, and Rav Kook is born in Latvia. He is not living in Israel. He doesn't come to Israel until he's roughly 40 years old. So the majority of his life is actually spent outside of Israel. He takes the position of chief rabbi of Yafo at, let's see, age 39 or so, 39, 40, in 1904. So he's 39 years old, again, in 1904. And one of the interesting things is that when he comes in his writings prior to 1904, there's much less about Zionism. In 1904, I believe, is also the year that Herzl dies, which is interesting. And once he comes to Israel, that clearly has a very profound impact on him. Yafo, where he's the chief rabbi, and its surrounding areas have many secular Zionists, and he begins to gain appreciation for their contributions, and he sees them as part of this divine plan, and so his commitment to Zionism begins to increase. 1914, he is traveling to Europe, actually, to try to raise money for the religious Zionist movement, and to convince the Aguda, which is the more right-leaning anti-Zionist movement, to be supportive of the religious Zionist agenda. And of course, 1914, World War I breaks out, he gets trapped there for the war, right? Against his will, he spends 5 years first in Switzerland, then in London. He's the rabbi of the Machzike Hadas community, I think from roughly 1916 to 1919. 1919, he's called back to Israel, first to be chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, and then he's almost immediately involved in negotiations to become the first chief rabbi, Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Mandate Palestine. He takes that position in 1921 until the end of his life in 1935. Strong opposition to Rav Kook from some of the secular Zionists on the one hand, and certainly and especially from the more right-leaning co-religionists. They did not treat him well at all, with some exceptions. Certainly there were Gedoli Hador who had tremendous respect, but people who are much lower than the great of the greats did not treat him well, did not treat him respectfully, on the whole, unfortunately, which, well, that's their loss, because he's one of the great heroes and clearly has an unbelievable impact. And he was a lone voice in the wilderness. I mean, he was willing to go out at a time when among a very deeply religious population and rabbinic community, religious Zionism was quite unpopular. And he even disagreed with he did not toe the party line. He did not just follow the Mizrahi. He was embroiled in all sorts of arguments with the sort of traditional mainstream religious Zionist movement. So he had his own way. He was more of a mystic rather than a pragmatist, and lived a life that was incredibly inspiring as a religious Zionist. So he has a couple of these poems after he lives in Israel. It's very instructive to compare before and after, which we're not going to do. But you can see the ones before are much less about Zionism and more about general mysticism and religious connection. And the ones afterward increasingly were about his love for Israel and about this play of interplay between exile and redemption. He believed very strongly that this was the beginning of the redemption. And yet things were very difficult. 1904... the economy of Israel was in desperate straits. No one thought they had a fighting chance to continue. Forget a state of Israel. No one was thinking. I mean, Herzl and a couple of dreamers started thinking about that, but the very survival of these kibbutzim was questionable at best. It was, these were, very difficult times. And Rav Kook was quite aware, and many of his psukim had to do with agriculture. He was the one who said you can sell the lands to the Arabs on Shemitah, because these are desperate, you know, you can't, it's just not practical. And so he's very acutely aware of the economic challenges facing, and existential challenges facing, the nascent Jewish settlements in Israel. So look at this first poem on the left side. We're going to start with, if you look on the photocopies, it's the one that says Mem Gimel on the bottom left, and it says Umachashavti Mishotetet. Everyone sees that? Umachashavti Mishotetet. He says Umachashavti, and these are just like, most of Rav Kook's writings were just taken from his diaries. He just wrote personal diaries, stream of consciousness, beautiful poetry, prose, whatever it was, unbelievable. So he says, Umachashavti Mishotete. And this really caught my eyes. Because what did we say? Right? He's saying, my mind wanders. My mind, Mishotete. I find it very plausible, but I find it highly implausible, or highly unlikely, that this is not connected to Rebbe, right? Me Yitznini Mishotete, who, if only you would allow me to wander. Right, so Rav Kook is wandering as well, following the model of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, except that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi only sees a potential vision, and Rav Kook has now moved to Israel, and he's starting to live out the redemption. Although we're not there yet, it's a desperate time, but he's actually there, living out the imagination of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and seeing that maybe something can come of all this. So he says, my mind wanders to the edges of the land. That's exactly what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was imagining himself doing. He was floating across the land of Israel. Mekom sham nechitim, the place where their nechitim, which is to be put down, where they were put down, achim nidachim. Right, the wandering brothers, which I believe is a biblical reference to who was wandering to look for his missing brothers.
Yosef's brothers.
Excellent, right? This is, I think, clearly a reference to Yosef and his brothers. Yaakov sends Yosef to Shechem to look for his brothers, right? To search them out, and that leads to the whole story of them putting him in the pit and so on and so forth. Well, these lost brothers, he is searching them out. And I think this is very, very interesting, almost as if to say that Rav Kook is a modern-day Yosef. Now, that's interesting, but I think in a way it makes sense. Yosef had a vision for his brothers. He had a dream. Remember, Yosef was the dreamer. Yosef was the one who dreamed, right, that they would ultimately bow to him. On the one hand, he was the person of exile, because he was the one who dreamed that they'd have to come down and bow down to him in famine and so on and so forth. But Yosef was also the one who then did what? Charged his brothers and charged his family to take his bones and to bring it back up to the land of Israel, which is exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu discharged. He discharged that responsibility. So Rav Kook is almost a modern day Yosef who's searching out for his brothers that are lost, that are dispersed, that are in exile, and he's saying to them, and he's thinking as follows: Hakodrim Yagon, these brethren are literally pierced through. Okay, Lekdor is like to take a spear and to pierce it through someone's heart. So there's that sense of through one's heart. Miyagon, out of suffering. Be'efes nichomim, with zero consolation. Hanilchamim al bitzalim uftote lechem, who fight for onions. What's he referring to? These yishuvim, right? The first kibbutz has not quite been established, I think. I want to say Deganya is the first kibbutz, like 1907. It was around this time. I don't know exactly. That's not true. That's not fair. I don't know the exact date. It could be it was already in. But these settlements, whether they're kibbutzim or just the settlements, were clearly, again, agriculturally, this is what he's referring to. They're fighting for onions, all right? Uftote lechem, and scraps of bread. So what he wants to do is to go to his brethren who are struggling so mightily. And by the way, it might not only be people at present time, but when else might he be imagining? Right? And this is how Jews have been eking through living in Israel for thousands of years. right? For millennia, literally. We know, we're confident historically, and I believe this has been historically verified, that there has been a continuous Jewish presence in Israel throughout, no matter the challenges. But that doesn't mean it was easy. When Yehuda HaLevi made Aliyah, the king said, when the Chacham wanted to go, what the king said was historically true. I mean, really, there's nothing there. Ramban, Nachmanides, also toward the end of his life, makes Aliyah, and there's next to nothing. I mean, he can't make it in Yerushalayim. The Rambam tells us, there's a letter, the authenticity of this letter is questionable, but we know that the Rambam tried to live in Israel, and probably for economic reasons, it was just impossible, and so they ultimately settled in Cairo. But it was impossible. So I think Rav Kook is referring to both the contemporary community and to millennia Jewish communities who are just, struggling to get by, just physically. V'or cheled ki yakum, this great light, when it arises, la'am mitzion, for the nation from Zion. And remember, the Yehuda HaLevi, this is a classic metaphor, but mi'irayich, orayich, light was a major metaphor throughout the poem, lo nigla lamo, had not yet been revealed to these people. And so Rav Kook now addresses them directly, and he says, just like Rav Yehuda HaLevi said, Sion, halo tishali, talks to her directly, talks to the city. He says to his brethren, achim nidachim, says Rav Kook, my lost brothers, Ela Avakesh. Sorry, it's in third person, I apologize. But he speaks about them, says, these brethren that are wandering, I seek them out. Which is, again, the same language as with Yosef. Lihagid lohem, to tell them, ki natsatso ra, that their light has blossomed. Their light has blossomed. Unbelievable. And so it's almost as if he's going throughout geographically, but also temporally throughout history. Like Rav Yehuda HaLevi imagined himself wandering, and he too is wandering, except Rav Yehuda HaLevi, all he wants, he doesn't have good news to share. He's just dreaming of a time. He's just going back in history. He's reminiscing. Rav Kook says, what Rav Yehuda HaLevi dreamed of, I can now begin, we've begun the process of actualizing. And this Natsatzoram is based on a classic phrase. It's based on a number of sources, but one of the sources is as a Yerushalmi. And the Gemara Yerushalmi actually compares the redemption to Kima Kima Kalor HaShachar. It comes a little bit at a time, like the rising of the dawn. But it doesn't come all at once, that there's that first ray of light, and there are more and more and more rays of light that you see, but it's that very first ray of light that you see, that is the first sign of the redemption. Who sees that here, and that's what he's imagining. So
it's a physical, I think, awakening, it's, and a spiritual awakening.
That's right. It's all of the above. For him, they're all the same. Physical and spiritual are tied together. For Rav Kook, everything. He's a monist. Everything is tied together because it's all connected. He's a monist in the sense of, right from monism means one, as opposed to like a dualist. So in other words, everything is unified for him because he believes everything has a spark of divinity and God brings everything together. So for Rav Kook, the physical and the spiritual, physical sustenance is actually symbolic in turn of spiritual return, that they're all wrapped up together. And it's not just a material precondition, it's almost a symbol, or it's almost one and the same for him. All right. I'm now going to go. I'm not going to do all the ones that I had copied here.
Not Galut.
I'm not going to do Galut, although it has...
We know about that.
We know about that one. Let me just point out, we're not going to read this whole one, but I will point out that he does clearly, again, draw on this one from Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, it would appear at least. If you take a look on the page Memhei at the bottom left, he uses the word tikva on a number of occasions. So Ushlom Asir Tikva, which was made famous by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, he says, for example, in the third stanza, Ki Yanitz Neit, it's that same when the breakthrough of light comes through. It's using the metaphor of the morning again, L'tikva Shaviv. Right, so that's that sense of the rising of the dawn as a sign of hope. So you have the tikva there, and then if you go a little bit later, he has as well the last stanza on that one, vatikvat so edet, the hope takes go step by step. Again, it's He's telling the people, he's telling himself, but he's also telling the people of his time, just because it hasn't fully materialized, don't be skeptical, don't be cynical about it. This is the beginning of redemption. It goes very slowly, right? Slowly but surely. It hopes and yet it is afraid. There's this sense of this tension that the community is feeling in the early years, in the 1900s, in the 1910s, 1920s, about what this will be. Rav Kook, the ultimate optimist, says this will ultimately, this is aspirational, this will lead to something good. And so again, coming back, I think, to those same motifs, so you see it again. If you turn to the next one, he also talks about the weakness and strength, this tension, but that ultimately he sees positive coming out of it. This is on page Mem Vav, where it says, V'chalasha hi umati. Literally, my nation is weak. So that sounds, again, he's emphasizing the difficulty. But take a look here as well. V'chalasha hi umati. My nation is weakened to gviata rafa. And it's gvia, which means its corpse almost is weakened. Right? V'rucha mitnodeid. Its spirit is diminished. Kikane b'mayim, like a reed that just simply floats on the river. It's just, it's lifeless. It's just carried by something else that has a life force. But it almost has no life force of its own. And yet, v'nishmata b'kirba, yet its soul is still inside of it. Kishchat kim chazaka. Reference to Pasuk and Tehillim, as it points out on the bottom, like shachak, like the thunderous voices of the heaven that are powerful. Yoda'at hi eterka, still knows its value. Skulat chayeha, the treasure of her life. Lo eget hi lechomitzikeha, she mocks all those who cause it harm. This is an inversion of scenarios such as in the book of Ovadia, where it talks about the ancient Edomites who mocked the Jews as they were being sent into captivity, right? And Rav Kook is saying, guess who's laughing now? I mean, it's quite literally what he's saying, right? We're now we can laugh back. Gambeilif nehentid rapes, even at a time when before them, we are weak in Yodad, he et kosna, she knows her armor, shehu la'adomed, right? We are eternity, says Rav Kook, we stand forever. Yodad, he givurat sorereha, shehu ach tel over, and she also knows in her heart of hearts that she knows that the apparent great strength of her enemies, in fact, is merely tel over, like we say in Rosh Hashanah, in Yom Kippur. In Unatana Tokef, that's just a passing shadow. So that which is apparent is actually just passing, and we have inner strength. Don't look at the outside only, look at the inner soul, the inner spirit. Giborahi, and this is why I wanted to read this, Kikfira. Right? Now, I can't prove that he took this from Rabbi Halevi, but we can definitely, I think we can say with confidence that he's drawing heavily on Rabbi Halevi's imagery, and that Rabbi Halevi was a hero for him and was a model as a poet. So I suspect that, again, Klal Yisrael are compared to a young lion, but I think it's all going together. Giborahi kikfira be'it yachim levava, right? This is lahavdil. This is something out of like the Lion King, right? Where you see like the, I suspect Rav Kook wasn't thinking about that for multiple reasons, right? But this is like the young lion, right? That all of a sudden, kiyachim levava, when the heart becomes heated up, right? And this is taken from the story of the blood avenger, which is the kiyachim levavot, says in the Torah, when there's a sense of inflame the passions, right? But that's what it's talking about here, like a young lion who finally comes into itself and all of a sudden gains strength. Amitza kilvia. Now all of a sudden has the strength of a grown-up, right? Of a lioness, a grown-up. Bihilachama bad gureha, when she fights to defend her cubs. Right? Unbelievable. So Klal Yisrael is growing up before our eyes, growing back. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi said that we are like a this little kfira, right? A little one. And now all of a sudden we're rising up, we're maturing ourselves to stand up, to defend ourselves. This is almost anticipating, you know, Haganah and Tzahal and so on and so forth. Unbelievable. But again, it's almost in dialogue with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi across the ages. And the last one I want to look at is on page Nun Aleph, entitled Shofar. Feel free to look at the other ones as well. You'll see some other, I think, allusions to Rav Kook. Shofar. Now, Shofar, of course, Rosh Hashanah, and we talked about the talked about that image of drawing on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, on that image that we say from Unitana Tokef. But this is very interesting because we know that on Rosh Hashanah we refer to the shofar as not only an instrument that we blast once a year, but it's also a sign, and biblically this is true as well, of the presence of God and ultimately of messianic redemption. And if you take a look at the blessings that we say on Rosh Hashanah in Musaf, in the section of Musaf called Shofaro, we talk not about so much about shofar and tshuva, we actually talk about shofar, tekabe shofar gadol cherutenu, and we're talking about the shofar, the heralds of the coming of the Mashiach. So he says, El Rosh Ahar Ale, go up to the top of the mountain, the Ha Rosh Ahar, going up to the mountain. The shofar gadol kach, take a great shofar. V'sa inecha ure'e, lift up your eyes and see. Just like Rav Kook referred to the Brit Bin Habtarim, this is a reference to when God says to the same Avraham Avinu, lift up your eyes and see that your children will be like the stars of the heaven. Enut ha'am hadach, enut, which is the same word that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, enut, live up, right? Enut libi, he uses well. The suffering of this impoverished nation, uva shofar hagadol tzika, that's right, you just got right. Right, that's also from Natana Tokef, right? You'll blow a great shofar, tzkiat turah ushvarim, with all the different sounds, uvraglacha rika, and with your legs you will cause this heavenly noise, v'yirashu hakivarim, right? And what's this a reference to? The tombstones, tzkiat hametim, tombstones will all of a sudden be shaking. Right, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wanted to just see the tombstones. He traveled over them, and now Rav Kook sees and he says, "No, now they're actually coming back to life. This is the beginning of redemption." Akolot yalu b'ludin, they will come forth mixed up together at shorshei hanshamot, and they will pierce to the sources of the souls. V'itzgal gilua gilgulin. Right, which means that they will roll, which means actually a double entendre. Physically, they will roll toward Israel. All bodies will roll to Israel at the time of Mashiach, but also that he believes in the transmigration of the souls, the Kabbalistic concept that the souls are coming, are being revisited. They're all coming back. Livnot eshashmamot, to build the desolate places. V'itaru anir damim, those who are sleeping will be weakened. Nine ha'arayot, okay, the children of the lions. Hamasachakim bizramim, who play, again, right, like the fear, who are playing in the streams, and yet v'shogim b'hazayot, they scream b'hazayot, which means with sprinkles, which probably means the sprinkling of dew at the time of Tkiat HaMetim, which I suspect what that means. V'akitzu ha'yishenim, they will awaken those who are sleeping. In other words, going back to the yishenim, right, the Yishenei Afar, that's what we talk about in Shemona Esrei, those who are sleeping in dust, right? The Tardimana Gola, in the sleep, in the slumber of the exile, the Oru Hazonim, and they will awaken those who have gone astray, Ba'alei Ha'ozen Ha'areila, those who have the, in other words, even the sinful ones, even those who have a circumcised ear, will be awakened, V'yakum V'yalula Aretz, will stand up, will arise, ascend to the land, Horim b'kirbam malachu. Again, horim, a reference to the avot. Malachu, again, another phrase that Rehuda Halevi had, in which they ruled. V'yasimu keitz v'keretz agalut shebahudachu, and will bring an end to the exile in which they were dispersed. Going back not just to Rehuda Halevi, but going back to the phrase that we started with, right? Who's the address in our first poem? Achim nitachim, the brothers who are wandering, right? Remember. So like a lucha bagudachu, to the exile in which they were dispersed, and that brings us back to the other poem of Rav Kook, Achim nitachim, right? Yosef and the brothers that he called back to the dispersed brothers, he's looking for them. Don't you know? This is the beginning of the messianic redemption. And so I see this as not only inspiring, but I think this is a dialogue between Rav Kook and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi across time. Says Rav Kook, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, you are my inspiration, but not only are you my inspiration, but because of you and because of your vision and in line with your eternal vision and that which you represented from the Jews for thousands of years, we are now actually living it out. I'm not just going to wander. I can imagine myself wandering, going to the Jews and say, now we see Kinatzat Zaram, it's actually beginning to arise. And if that was true for Rav Kook in the early parts of the 20th century, certainly although things are far from perfect and far from fully messianic, still that sense of this deep appreciation for the miracle of what we have witnessed since Rav Kook's lifetime and more so since the founding of the State of Israel, all those who gave their lives and who made all those tremendous sacrifices, those who were lions, as we say in the Kalmalek, Arayot Gaveru. It's the same lions. They have the bravery to give their lives, they have the bravery to fight on our behalf, and ultimately we have grown as a nation that has made the sacrifices, yes, and at the same time has risen from the ashes to rebuild and to live out this vision. So to me, the dialogue across the ages between these two great heroes of mine, I think really speaks about the dialogue across the ages between us sitting here today and sitting with Medina Israel upon the eve of her 70th birthday. And we really are very much in dialogue with Jews and Zionists throughout the generations, going back to the time of Avot. I think it truly is a special time. I thank you for your time. Wish everyone a meaningful Yom HaZikaron and a very joyous Yom HaAtzmaut Sameach.